Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
That war rocket Ajax to bring back his body.
And welcome to War Rocket Ajax. This is the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast. We're your hosts. My name is Chris Sims. With me, as always, is Mr. Matt Wilson. Matt, how are you tonight?
Chris, I am doing great. I'm enjoying a cheerful wine. That's cheer wine. I'm not drinking actual wine.
That is why people who are from the South think it's wine when I say I'm drinking cheer wine.
I don't know how long it's been since we've had actual alcoholic beverages while recording this show.
Buddy, it was a big thing circa 2010.
We grew up and stopped doing that. But I'm doing well. Chris, I hope you're doing well.
You might need to drive over, Matt, because I was given by Greg Black the gift of the Cheerwine Holiday Punch from this year. Yes, it was in stores in December. Yes, it is currently mid-July.
What's the expo date on that?
No idea. No idea. It's a 2-liter. It's sealed.
It's probably still good.
It's probably still fine.
Well, I'm excited to hear a report on that, on the holiday cheer wine. I wonder what makes it holiday. Does it have a sprig of holly in it?
Yeah, there's a sprig of holly in it, which I believe would be poisonous. Mistletoe is poisonous. Is holly poisonous?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
You'll let us know, listeners. When somebody doesn't know something on a podcast, that's your time to shine.
I feel like I'm being called out because I always text you while I'm listening to Smark of the Beast. Matt, what do we do here on this show besides drink Southern sodas and snipe at each other?
I'd say those are the number one and two things we do. Number three is we talk about comics and pop culture, and we talk to people in the world of comics and pop culture. This week, we have quite a get as a guest. We're going to be talking to Mr. Josh Williamson, the current writer of The Flash, the writer of some recent Justice League content that has been extremely good.
Some JLC.
Some real good JLC. And we're going to have a great time talking to Josh. But before we get to talking to Josh, Chris, as always, we have some business to take care of. We're going to start with thanking our newest supporters on Patreon.
That's right, Matt. These are the people who they were putting the money in the envelopes. They were putting a stamp on them, a commemorative stamp. And they were addressing those envelopes to those friendly War Rocket Ajax boys down at 411 Gimmick Street. But you don't have to do that anymore. You can just go to patreon.com/War Rocket Ajax and you can kick in as little as a dollar every month to help support the show and help us pay those gimmicks they keep sending in the mail called bills.
Yeah, that's how you can learn the true 411 and be just like these people. Aaron.
Well, thank you, Aaron.
Leroy Colson.
Thank you, Leroy.
And Michael Rivera.
Thank you, Michael.
If you would like to be like any of those wonderful people, you can head over, as Chris mentioned, to patreon.com/warrockajax and kick in as little as $1 a month to help us keep the show rolling. And you will get cool stuff like ad-free episodes of everything that we do. At a higher level than that, you get bonus content. All our bonus content level people this week got 2 full hours of Chris and James from the One Shot Podcast talking about Wizard School. And people at higher levels get line-stepping privileges for our list segments. Folks get physical rewards and other cool stuff. So if any of that sounds like something you would be interested in, then head over to the Patreon and help us out. All right, Chris, with that, let's do some checks and wrecks.
Let's do it. So come over and check
yourself before you wreck yourself. Chris, what do you have to check in with this week?
Matt, I have not been doing much. I have to admit, I've been in kind of recovery mode, work mode, been focusing a lot on work. Because I have a new series that just got announced from Marvel Comics coming out. It's a little bit of a spoiler, but if you read the fourth issue of Infinity Countdown Darkhawk, you'll know that on that last page, your boy Sleepwalker showed up.
Yeah, boy.
And that means that we are doing another four issues. We're going to be doing Infinity Wars Sleepwalker. That's me and Chad. Here's something exciting. Todd Nock is drawing it, which I'm pretty stoked about. He's great. I remember we actually started emailing him and we were like, yeah, you did a signing at the store where we worked and we talked to you about Wild Guard for 2 hours. that was us. So he's doing some amazing stuff. We're going to be introducing some pretty fun takes on some characters that I think people are going to really like. But Chad's been wanting to do Sleepwalker forever. I think he actually pitched Sleepwalker a couple years ago. And so for us to finally do it has been super, super fun. There's so much weird stuff going on in this book. It might be the weirdest one we've ever done for Marvel. So definitely check that out. But yeah, that got announced this week. And I'm really pleased with where we're going with that and who we're working with and everything about it, I think, is going to be super fun.
Todd Nock, I think, is a very underrated Spider-Man artist and other types of artists as well. But in particular, I am a fan of his Spider-Man work. So I'm excited about all of that to come as well.
You know who else is a fan of his Spider-Man work?
Who's that?
President Barack Hussein Obama.
Oh, yeah. He drew the Obama issue of Spider-Man. That is.
Yes, he did.
Totally true. Yes.
Matt, what are you up to this week?
Well, Chris, you and I have something coming up that we need to let people know about because, look, folks, I'm going to level with you. We need you to help us make this good. we need this to be worth our while. We are going to both be appearing at Wizard World Winston-Salem at the Benton Convention Center in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. The weekend of August 3rd, 4th, and 5th. That is the first weekend in August. I've never done a Wizard World before. Chris, is this your first Wizard World also?
It sure is.
So we don't know what to expect at all. I can tell you that the guest list is interesting. The Penguin from Gotham is going to be there.
Yeah, I'm planning on paying $40 to get my picture taken with Hot Penguin.
Hot Penguin is there.
Alfred, Ozzy.
A lot of Gotham people are there. Little Bruce.
A lot of Gotham people.
Alfred. Will Friedle from Boy Meets World.
He was a Batman. There.
He was a Batman.
He was a Batman.
And most importantly, Rookie of the Year will be appearing.
Okay. You and I have talked about this. I don't want to step on your check, Matt. What's Rookie of the Year doing at all these Wizard World cons? I'm not mad at him. I don't want him to not be there, but it seems like a weird, because he's in a lot of them.
Well, I think we talked to Kyle Starks about this when Kyle was on the show and he was going to be doing a Wizard World. He just goes to all of these, apparently. I need to look at the schedule for every upcoming Wizard World to see if Rookie of the Year is going to be... Let's see if he's at the Boise show. That is this weekend.
Okay.
Yes, he is.
What is Rookie of the Year doing? I would not want to take it away from him, and if you were a fan of Rookie of the Year, the movie that gave us the phrase funky butt lovin', because that is where it comes from, then by all means, get to a Wizard World.
Let me tell you what the most bullshit thing that ever happened that was.
Okay, hit me.
Rookie of the Year is at all of these. Also, Samantha Newark is at all of these from Jim and the Holograms.
Yeah, the voice of Jim. That's actually one I'm genuinely excited about,
That's not the bullshit thing. Also, apparently, Charisma Carpenter comes to all of these. Animal from the Road Warriors is at the Boise show, but not at the Winston-Salem show.
I mean, Matt, I bet that's because... Well, no, I guess that's not really close to Chicago, is it?
He should definitely be coming to Winston-Salem. I feel robbed that I am not going to be seeing one of the Road Warriors at this show I'm going to. Here's something that will be very appealing to you, Chris. The Tulsa show in September.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas Ian Nicholas from the movie Rookie of the Year just added.
God bless him. Nothing but love for Rookie of the Year. It's just a weird, it just seems like an odd choice.
Also there, Charisma Carpenter.
That makes total sense. That makes total sense. She's Cordelia from Buffy and Angel.
Yeah, she just is at every one of those shows. Somehow, like, maybe he's somebody's friend. Maybe Rookie of the Year is somebody's friend. And he's at all of these.
Matt, can I level with you? Can I be 100% real?
Please be 100% real with me.
I do not know what to expect from this Wizard World show. It is going to be the last show of my 35th year. It's the first weekend in August, we should say that. First weekend in August in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. It's driving distance. I am absolutely happy to do it. They invited me, and I am excited about it. I do feel like it's going to be a weird crowd, because when I checked, I was the second most famous comic book writer there. And I'm not famous. It was Mike Grell at a strong number one, and then me.
Yeah, it's gonna be an interesting time. Happy to note that Thomas Ian Nicholas from Rookie of the Year is also at Wizard World Chicago. that's a much bigger show. There's actually a good number of comics guests at Wizard World Chicago. But yeah, it's we don't know what to expect. So if you are anywhere around, please come to Winston-Salem for Wizard World and see us. We want to see some happy, friendly faces.
And if we are not at our table, come find us at the nearest movie theater watching Uncle Drew.
Yeah, either Uncle Drew or Skyscraper. That's what we're going to for sure at some point during that convention, because we're going to do that for Movie Fighters. All right, that's my check. Chris, what's your recommendation?
I can probably get through this one pretty quick. It's Glow Season 2, which rules.
Yeah, I will second that recommendation wholeheartedly.
Glow Season 1 I thought was great, and I heard a lot of people saying, several reviews actually of it, saying Glow Season 2 was the best original content Netflix had ever produced. I cannot dispute those reviews.
Yeah, not wrong. Not wrong. I can't think of anything, any original content on Netflix that I have watched that I liked more.
Alison Brie's great. Betty Gilpin's amazing. Everyone in the cast is amazing, but Betty Gilpin, like, kills it.
Betty Gilpin was good in the first season. She steps up to an incredible level in season two.
Yeah, she's phenomenal in this one. Can we talk about episode 8 real quick?
I would love to.
Okay, so episode 8 is an episode of Glow.
Like the show within the show.
Yeah, it is presented to the audience as though it is an episode of the pro wrestling show they are making in the show. So it's a full, like, half hour of just, like, the bits and sketches and matches that would have been on an episode of Glow. It's fucking great. It's so good.
Yeah, it's so good. It makes me want an entire Glow show.
Yeah.
With these characters.
Here's my only problem with Glow Season 2. Mark Maron could not look more like Stan Lee, and it's weird.
Okay, that is not what I was expecting the problem to be.
No, it's like, I was watching it, and for the first, like, three episodes, because Aiden and I watched it all on the 4th of July, which is, you know, I decided not to work that day, even though I'm a freelancer. I took the day off, we had some bratwurst, and we watched all episodes, like 10 episodes of Glow, I mean, and it was great.
What better way to celebrate America than to spend it with Liberty Bell?
Yeah, exactly. And her daughter, Savannah Rose. And for like the first three episodes, I was like, why does he look so familiar? Why does he look exactly like someone I know? And then I realized it's not someone I know. It's Stan Lee from 1975 that he looks 100% like.
He does. He does. I mean, he's got
the glasses.
He's got the little soul patch, which I don't think Stan ever had. And his hair's a little longer, but yeah, he could be playing Stan Lee in a movie.
He could be playing, like, no, you say his hair's a little longer. Go look at that. Go look at the Stan Lee nude picture. The famous Stan Lee nude.
I'm going to Google that right now. It's going to be my Google history.
Which is not a joke. It does exist.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's not like a full nude. He's posed. It's artful.
holding a comic in a strategic place. Yes,
and it's a treasury size, so you know. But yeah, it looks exactly like him in a way that's weird. Here's the things I really liked about Glow: half hour episodes, and it doesn't drag.
Yeah, never.
Every episode is a banger. It does not do the Netflix thing where it's like 13 episodes long and three are kind of boring. It's like 10 half-hour episodes. Perfect.
Yeah, if anything, it leaves you wanting more, and that's what a show like that ought to do. A show that you can binge, specifically. You should be able to binge it really quick and then be like, that's it? That's the ideal kind of binging show. My actual only complaint about the season is that there is not enough Machu Picchu.
Fair.
I wish that she had more to do in season two. Although I will say Kia Stevens is another, like, wow, she was good in the first season, but she got so much better in the second season. Like, she really stepped it up.
She gets a spotlight episode.
She gets a spotlight episode, and does she seize that spotlight.
Yeah, she's great.
That's Chris's recommendation.
Yeah, what's yours?
Mine is the one I teased last week. It's Nier Automata.
Okay.
Which I actually played all the way through it and got all four endings as of this recording. I don't know if I like 100% loved it. The story is, honestly, when you get to the end of it, kind of a bummer. That said, it did keep me going all the way through. Like, it compelled me to keep playing. And the gameplay is varied and fun enough. And when you get used to the combat, it's really pretty enjoyable. Either the parts where you're doing like kind of like action RPG combat, or where you're doing bullet hell kinds of things, where you're having to dodge projectiles and shoot projectiles back at enemies. It's also just full of like really creative, clever stuff that reminds me not so much of JRPGs or Square Enix kind of games, which Square Enix is the publisher of that game, but reminds me in weird ways of Metal Gear Solid, where, you know, after the game ends one time, you restart a new game and you're playing as a different character. Then you restart a game the third time, and not only are you playing as a different character, but it's not concurrent with the other two games. You're actually continuing the story. So each time you start a new game, it's not actually a new game. You're just playing a different portion of the story. And that happens four times. Also, the game has 26 endings. It has four main story endings, actually five main story endings. And then the other 21 endings are all gag endings that you get by performing certain actions in the game, and like some kind of goofy thing happens. Here's an example. There's a part in the game where you're told by another character, hey, I caught this fish. Why don't you come get the fish and see what happens when you eat it? I don't know what it does to androids, because the characters in the game are androids. So you go find that character, you talk to her, she gives you the fish. If you eat the fish, you die, and the game ends. Which is
what
nuts.
Is this game?
It's so weird. It's so weird and like kind of goofy at times. There's another ending where if you make a certain choice at the end of the game, the ending credits become a mini game where you know you're like a little like video game spaceship and you're shooting the credits which are trying to attack you. And if you make it all the way through without dying, you get another secret ending. It's just full of like weird, creative, video gamey stuff like that, which again reminds me of the weird shit in Metal Gear Solid, like the stuff in Metal Gear Solid 2 where it starts breaking the fourth wall like crazy at the end. That's what it made me think of so much, and that's what really compelled me to keep playing the game, to see the next weird thing. It wasn't so much the kind of bummer of a story. It was the weirdness that perpetuated me through the game. So if any of that sounds like it would be fun for you, I believe Nier Automata is fairly cheap right now on Amazon, or if you want to buy it from the PlayStation Store or something like that. So I would definitely recommend it just to kind of catch a whiff of all that weirdness that's in the game. Let's review some of the comics that came out this week.
I would love to talk to you about comics that came out this week, Matt.
Superman number one. It came out. It follows up Man of Steel, which we thought was kind of a mixed bag. And I think Superman number one is also kind of a mixed bag.
It is 50-50. And let me tell you, the good 50, that top 50, is all the stuff of Clark Kent. Like, alone. Like, Clark Kent thinking about Lois and John not being around.
Yeah, like his flashbacks to Lois and John. Even though John still talks like a little adult.
Yeah, weird. But that stuff is so choice and, like, such good Superman stuff. And the part where Clark goes back to the Daily Planet and he's writing about Superman's new Fortress of Solitude. And he's like, he deletes a paragraph because it thinks he makes him sound like an asshole.
Well, no, the only thing, the caption box, all he says is ego.
Yeah, ego.
That's so good.
It's brilliant. Like, I am genuinely, and I actually wrote about this for Polygon this week. I am blown away by how good Bendis is at writing Clark Kent, at writing Superman, the guy. It's mind-boggling. Because it's so different from everything we've seen Bendis do before. He's never written a character like Superman. Like,
and he's got it. He has Superman. The problem is everybody else.
I'll tell you what the problem is it's that caption box at the end that says, next Rogelzar returns.
Yeah, I don't want Rogelzar back.
I hate that I don't have to look up his name anymore because I wrote an article about it.
I think his Lois is pretty good, even though, like we said last time, it seems weird to, like, take Lois off the board. Because that feels like the character Bendis would want to write the most.
Yeah. Yeah, like, Lois seems like she would work really well with all of his, like, signature dialogue tics, which Superman doesn't have, by the way.
He does not. He does not. To be fair, most of the, like, the name characters in the book don't have those verbal tics. The characters that have those verbal tics are, like, villains and, like, regular people.
Yeah. I feel like Bendis has been writing ensemble books for so long because he's been on Avengers since what, like, since it's got to be since 2005. Like, when was Avengers disassembled?
Yeah.
It's like 2005.
That sounds about right, yeah.
Like, he's been writing ensemble books so long that you kind of forget that he's really good at books, like, focused on one guy. Like, one character, I should say. Like, that's one of the reasons that Alias was so good, was because it was singularly focused on Jessica Jones. And, like, even, like, a lot of the Spider-Man stuff is kind of singularly focused, even when there's a larger cast.
Well,
people don't sound the same when he's focused like that.
Yeah, I mean, when Bendis felt most like Bendis to me, like, good Bendis to me, on the Miles Morales Ultimate Spider-Man stuff that he was doing.
Yeah.
Up until pretty much he left Marvel. But the stuff that doesn't work really is the stuff, like, I've seen people say that Martian Manhunter seems so out of character in the sequence where Martian Manhunter tries to talk Superman into basically taking over Earth, that he must not be Martian Manhunter. He must be some kind of imposter who is fooling Superman into thinking he's Martian Manhunter.
It's a weird scene, and it's very weird for that to be Martian Manhunter. But at the same time, I have no handle on Martian Manhunter and who he is right now.
I don't think that's an imposter. I think that's supposed to for real be straight up Martian Manhunter.
No, I think it is too. And I think, like, the justification that I can have for that character moment is when he goes, look, just offer. Like, offer to guide them. Like, make yourself available if they want to take you up on it. You don't have to, like, he does say takeover, but he later says that. That could be a thing that, like, 2018 Martian Manhunter is all about. I don't know. I know a lot about 1998 Martian Manhunter. I don't know nothing about Martian Manhunter for the last 10 years. That dude was in Stormwatch.
Yes, he was. I feel like a lot of the context that's given for that scene makes a case that Martian Manhunter would be reasonably saying this. I don't think, again, I don't think he's an imposter. I do think it's weird. I do like Superman's reaction to it, which is he never gets mad. He never says, like, just shut up. Like, he never says, like, full on no. He's just kind of like, okay, John, I'll think about it. But probably no.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, he's very polite about it. He's very, like, Kansas farm boy about it, which is, again, Bendis nailing Superman as a character.
I feel like that's Martian Manhunter because of process of elimination. Like, it has to be somebody in the Justice League saying it, but it's not going to be Batman. It's not going to be Wonder Woman.
No.
Like, it's not going to be Hal Jordan wouldn't say that. Flash wouldn't say it.
The only other person who maybe would say it would be Aquaman.
Yeah. I don't know what that dude's up to these days either. So
the other thing that doesn't quite work for me in the issue is the revelation as Superman is flying around at the end of the book that, oh, hey, I'm in the Phantom Zone. Earth is in the Phantom Zone. Because it kind of comes out of nowhere.
It does come out of nowhere, but I like it.
I don't dislike it. I mean, it's the reason that we're going to see Rogelzar again.
I mean, I don't like that part.
But
how great would it be if Rogelzar shows up next issue and then he like pulls his head off and it's Terra Man? And Terra Man's like, it was me.
I would love for it to be Terra Man. But if it was seated somewhere in the issue before this, I missed it. Where Earth was actually in the Phantom Zone.
There's a small bit where Green Lantern talks about how they need to get like all the dangerous stuff that was in the fortress, and he mentions the Phantom Zone and the Phantom Zone projector. But that's the only like indication that anything will be happening on that last page.
Oh, one last thing. Well, two last things. First, we talked about the Martian Manhunter conversation. I did love how Superman kept flying off to like have entire issues of Superman stories for a single panel and then come back.
Superman fucking around and preventing an invasion by the Dominators by accident is pretty great.
Yeah. All that Superman stuff is super, super good. But like, it's the fact that it's all happening in the background instead of being like the main story in the book. I get it, but some of me wishes that it was the main stuff. Also, Arson storyline from Man of Steel also not at the forefront of this. It's kind of happening in the background, but it's not being foregrounded anymore.
It's very weird. I like that the arson story exists, and I like that Superman has these two problems that he's dealing with, right? Rogelzar, who is a cosmic genocide monster. Like, he killed Krypton. He went and killed the Bottle City of Kandor, and everybody in it who has weird names that Superman was listing off in that one issue. Also, someone setting fires in Metropolis. Both of those are of equal importance to Superman, and I really like that.
Yeah.
I really like that Superman is concerned with things on multiple levels commensurate with what he can do. That's really cool. I do not understand why this arson storyline is entering its eighth issue.
Yeah. One last thing to mention. I really like the Ivan Reis art in here.
Yeah.
It's exactly the style that he did in his Man of Steel issue, which again has kind of an Astro City vibe to it, and I think it's great.
Yeah. Yes to Clark Kent. No to Rogelzar.
That's where we're coming down on it. All right, Chris, up next, we're going to talk about the new Amazing Spider-Man number one. Written by Nick Spencer, with art by Ryan Ottley.
No, this is Jimmy Olsen's Nick Spencer.
That's right.
This is Jimmy Olsen for Superman's pal, Jimmy Olsen, and Superior Foes of Spider-Man, right? Like, those are his prior credits.
Those are the only ones.
Yep.
Speaking of Superior Friends, or Superior Foes of Spider-Man, there is a great idea in here. There's a few great ideas in this issue. And I don't want to totally trash it. The idea that Peter Parker is sharing a room, sharing an apartment with Boomerang, is very clever. Like, at first I was kind of like, why would Peter Parker do that, right? Like, what's the end game here? But it is explained. And that is, this is Peter's way of keeping an eye on Boomerang to see if he's going to do any, like, big crimes or anything. So this is his way of you know, keeping tabs on him. That makes sense. There's also a pretty good idea. Peter Parker gets disgraced in this issue. He is revealed as a plagiarist, and thus his doctorate is taken away, which leads him to get fired from the Daily Bugle. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that got, like, built up in the Dan Slott run gets taken away from Peter, which I think occasionally you have to do. Like, every once in a while you have to remove the success from Peter Parker so he can go back to being Peter Parker from one. The problem is the plagiarism story doesn't make any fucking sense.
I actually really liked the idea of the plagiarism story and the idea of, like, you know what it is, Matt? It's fucking Marvel Universe bullshit, and I love it.
Yeah.
The idea that they invented this, what's it called? It's not Finder. What is it?
It's some technology that can find plagiarism of any kind, including
multiversal plagiarism,
including going into another dimension and finding another version of yourself.
Yeah. So there's somebody who, like, found an alternate version of themselves who got, like, a MacArthur Genius Grant and took their work and presented it as their own. That's like Astro City level, like, comic book nonsense. I loved it.
The thing that gets me, though, is so Peter gets dinged for committing plagiarism because they say that Dr. Octopus wrote the paper because, or the thesis, or the dissertation, or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Because Dr. Octopus was living in his body when that was written.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a step too far for me. Like, the explanation of it being like, oh, well, we're cutting off any way of somebody cheating, right? Okay, but that's not really plagiarism if, well, somebody else wrote it.
No, it's the plagiarism was from an old Otto Octavius paper.
So Doc Ock passed off an old paper as Peter Parker's new dissertation?
Doc Ock lifted stuff from his own work and presented it as Peter Parker's work is what happened.
Okay, I guess that makes some degree of sense. And I do like the stuff later where Peter's like, well, you know what? Once I got my body back, I didn't say, hey, I didn't earn this degree. I just kept it. That stuff I like. For whatever reason, though, and I like Ryan Hartley's art in it most of the time. At certain points, his Spider-Man's a little more angular than I necessarily am used to or want him to be, but that is Ryan Otley's style, and I don't dislike it. I think I just got to get used to it.
I like an angular Spidey.
For whatever reason, there are just certain things that did not click for me in this. Some of it feels like it's trying just really hard to be jokey.
Are you talking about Bye Felicia?
Okay, Bye Felicia. I didn't mind Bye Felicia. That was actually okay.
Oh, the app's called Watcher. Which is actually pretty funny.
That is pretty funny. The repeated joke that Spider-Man tells, like the one where he comes in to help the Avengers, and then there's a flashback where he does that joke for the first time. Like, I don't know that one lands.
There is weirdly, I do not think this was done on purpose, but there is weirdly a kind of variation of that joke in Squirrel Girl this week, too. Which, by the way, is a Kraven-centric issue, and you should read it because it's extremely dope.
The stuff where the Avengers are fighting those, like, alien headcrab kind of creatures,
uh-huh,
felt like a weird excuse for Ryan Otley to draw not blood, but blood like goo, because he did like so much of that on Invincible.
Maybe he just did it by reflex at this point.
It feels like it. It feels like it, but like that whole sequence didn't really work for me. And the number one thing that doesn't work for me is the deep implication that we're leading Peter and Mary Jane back together.
Do you not want Peter and MJ to get back together?
I don't know. I certainly don't want it to happen in a way, in the way that this seems to be implying, where they remember they were married.
Okay, that's fair. Let's real quick talk about our last comic of the week.
Okay. The last comic of the week is Die, Die, Die. I could just say Die, 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 but there's an exclamation mark after every die.
Yeah, it's the.
That's right.
Classic Simpsons. The content of this comic is... Not to dismiss it, this is Robert Kirkman writing. It's got Robert Kirkman and...
Bruce Burnham.
One of the producers on Walking Dead doing the story.
Oh, right, yes.
Whose name escapes me. Chris Burnham does the art. The story is, it's assassins, it's bloody, it's interesting. It's basically whatever. No disrespect to their craft. The big deal here is that this just showed up at comic book stores yesterday.
Scott Gimple is that guy's name, by the way.
They did not announce this comic. They kept it a secret and just matched orders on another Robert Kirkman book, like another Skybound book. So however many you ordered of that, that's how many you got of Die, 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 number one, for free. So when you came into a comic book store this week, there was a comic you'd never heard of. That's fucking amazing. That is also some shit you can only do if you got that Walking Dead money.
Yeah, that's the Beyonce visual album drop of comic sales.
Yeah. I love that this happened. I'm excited that like Chris Burnham was a part of it. You know, I'm a huge fan of Burnham, obviously, from everything, including Batman Incorporated.
And I think his art on this book is great. I also think the story is really intriguing. There's some stuff in it that's kind of like weirdly pushing the envelope for the sake of pushing the envelope, but I do like the idea, like the basic idea behind it of like going to great lengths to eliminate only the bad people without any consequences for good people to continue doing good things. Like it's the opposite of what a lot of these like government conspiracy kinds of stories are. Like in this case, the conspiracy is for good ends, right? With great lengths being taken to make sure that there aren't unintended consequences. And by the end of it, there's this twist that's going to make it much more character focused, it seems like. So it makes me excited for issue two. But yeah, I think the most notable thing about this has to be like just the way it landed.
Yeah, it's a stunt, and it's a pretty cool stunt. Like as someone who was in comics retail for a really long time, and as someone who, you know, like I had a book come out this week that, you know, announced the next thing I was doing, which was nice that we got to preserve that secret for this long. To get a whole comic done and Burnham not talk about it and Kirkman not talk about it and Scott Gimple, like no announcement whatsoever, is an extremely cool thing. So
yeah,
that's pretty cool.
My big question was, you know, well, how did the retailers not slip on this?
Oh, they didn't know either.
They didn't know. Yeah.
Yeah. You never tell the retailers.
All right. That's going to do it for our comic segment. Now, Chris, it's time for us to talk to Josh Williamson.
Oh, this should be fun. Joining us for the program this week is someone we are very excited to have back on the show. It's been a while, but you'll know him from his work on Justice League No Justice and Flash and the upcoming Justice League Odyssey. Joshua Williamson is here. Josh, how are you tonight, man?
I'm good. I'm tired. It was a long day of working, of making comic books.
I should have said, well, my original plan when I introduced you was I was going to say, you might know him as the person who has the only good Batman tattoo I've ever seen at a convention.
There's some good ones. I see good ones all the time. You know the Superman Batman logo was because, like, the logo they actually had on the Superman Batman comic, the Jeff Loeb Ed McGuinness one, was because they saw someone had that tattoo on a subway.
I did not know that.
They saw someone had it on a subway, and they were like, that is awesome, and they made that the logo.
Wait, did...
Like, they owe somebody money.
Did they tell them, or did they just... Did they just use it?
I don't think it was exact, but it was like a variation of that. But it was that. Yeah, I'm not. That's a public story. I mean, that's in the back of one of the hardcovers or something.
Yeah,
I'm not telling you a trace.
I mean, imagine being Jeff Loeb in that situation. Obviously, you're not going to go up to a guy and be like, "Hey, I write Superman and Batman. I'm going to use your leg." Like they would. Best case scenario, you get maced.
Yeah, that's really funny. When John Layman was writing Sentinel Squad, he named one of the characters after me. And so I'm in the first issue. I get killed in the first issue. And so the cover to Sentinel Squad, I'm on the cover technically, right? Because the Sentinel that I was in is on the cover. And one day I was at like Killer Burger here in Portland, and there was a guy in line, and he had the cover of those purple, they were purple, blue, and white Sentinels. And from X-Men, and he had the cover tattooed on his arm, like the whole cover tattooed on his arm. And I was like, yo, dude, that's awesome. Like, my friend wrote that, and technically I'm one of those Sentinels, right? And the guy had no idea what I was talking about. Like, he was not an X-Men fan or a Sentinel fan. He just liked this. He saw this image someplace, liked it, and decided to get it tattooed on his body. And I'm talking about, he was a big buff guy, and it was his entire... like upper arm. It was huge. It was like not like a small tattoo. It was like a huge part of this man's body. He had the cover of Sentinel Squad #1 and had no idea what I was talking about.
So do you, when you go to conventions,
yes,
do people want to show you their tattoos? Because I guess, do you want to describe your tattoo so listeners know what we're actually talking about?
Oh, it's the Batman symbol on the inside of my forearm, and then it has Bat kind of go away from it, like Batman logo is like away from it, and they intertwine with each other. But it goes down almost to my wrist, and then it goes up my arm a little. I've thought about getting it extended at times, but I haven't. I've gone back and forth on getting it extended or making additions to it. Someday. I've been debating on getting a Flash logo. I think I'm going to wait until I'm done with the book, and I feel like I did okay, and then maybe I'll get a Flash logo tattoo.
The reason I bring it up is that I've, you know, a lot of people ask me if I would get a tattoo, and I'm like, yeah, but like, there's only one thing that I've ever really loved my entire life enough that I could get a tattoo, and it's Batman. And I've known too many people with Batman tattoos that are jerks, and I always tell them the only good one is Josh Williamson. Like, the only good Batman tattoo.
Tattoos are so funny, dude, because like Batman logos, there's a bunch of them out there that you see and you're like, what are you thinking? But the ones that are always weird to me are the really bad Joker tattoos. If you get a Brian Boland, you know, Joker tattoo, that makes sense to me. But I see so many Joker tattoos, it looks like, I don't know, man. Somebody just drew it on the back of a napkin, handed the tattoo guy, and the guy did it. They look so ugly. A buddy of mine, his cousin was going to get a Joker tattoo, and it was like that. Where he saw what he was going to get tattooed, and he's like, where did you? He's like, I found it on the internet. And he was like, no, dude, let me draw you a better tattoo. So he drew him a cooler Joker tattoo. But yeah, conventions are funny like that. You'll see all kinds of stuff. The moment somebody looks at you and they see it, like if I'm doing a signing, especially at the DC booth, if somebody comes up and they're getting a book signed, the moment they see it, they just start showing me all their tattoos, especially if they have comic book tattoos. Like the moment they see it.
What's the weirdest one you've seen, or best? I'm not going to make you, like, call somebody out, but, like, one that sticks out in your memory, I guess.
I think the weirdest one is that Sentinel Squad one, because it was, like, that person had no idea what it was. I knew a guy who had on both of his arms, on his biceps, going around his arms. Like, you know, people have, like, barbed wire that will go around their arms? Mm-hmm. He had every single... major DC characters logo, like including Martian Manhunter. So it was like Batman, Superman, the Legion logo, like the L, Wonder Woman, like going around his arms. So like on his left arm, he had the Batman one with like a bunch of stuff, like the Green Lantern logo, the Flash logo, you know, going around. And then on his right arm, he had it where it was the Superman or the Batman logo or the Superman logo. And then it was going around again with a different set of character logos.
That is wild.
It was wild. I was like, oh man, I love this. But you know, Donny Cates has the DC Comics logo tattooed on him.
Like the bullet or like the new one?
Yeah, he has the bullet. I'm jealous. That's one of the ones I wish I had done. Like, oh, once I saw he had it, I was like, oh, like that's what I always wanted to do.
I hope they don't find out at Marvel.
Oh, I'm sure they know. But he also has Cosmic Ghost. He has Cosmic Ghost Rider tattooed on his arm, so I think he's okay.
Yeah, that's look. If you're willing to commit that far,
I've known Geoff Johns since I was like 18 or 19 years old, and he's always known I had. No, that's right. He did not know I had the Batman tattoo. And right after I got the job on The Flash, I saw him, and for somehow it was the first time he ever realized I had the Batman tattoo. And he looks at it and he goes, have you always had that? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, well, where's the Flash tattoo?
So, look, I'll say one more thing, and then we can actually talk about your comics. Yeah. I know a guy, one of the guys who was actually involved in the comics blogging internet back when I was coming up that way, who did in fact get the cover to Punisher War Journal number 19 tattooed on his leg. That is, you just run into Jesse to the Punisher, kiss that baby goodbye, the full Jim Lee cover tattooed That's on his awesome. Leg. That's the best comic book tattoo.
If you got to do it, you got to, you know, no half measures, right?
So let's talk about Flash. You've been on Flash for a while now.
Oh man, dude, I don't know if you realize this, but I've written a lot of Flash comics.
You've been on, I'm trying to think, like, have you been on longer than Wade at this point?
No. It's really weird because of double ship. So
is that 100 issues?
I have it right here, actually. I know the numbers. Wade was on it. Really weird, because Wade was on it from 62 to 129, from 143 to 162, and then again from 231 to 236. He was on it for 92 issues. Yeah, and Geoff was on it for, the first time around, was on it for 62 issues, but he also was on it, you know, through, because he came back on with Brightest Day Flash.
Mm-hmm.
But the person who has the most has to be Kerry Bates.
Oh, well, yeah.
Like, all those dudes, it's crazy. But what's interesting is that, and I've seen this, Mark Waid has the longest consistent run, kind of. I think I have the longest run in terms of I have no fillers. Like, Michael Morishi helped me write 2 issues, but there's no fillers on my Flash so far. So I think in terms of, like, Unbroken, I have the longest. But I've only been on the book for, issue 1 just came out, like, 2 years ago. But it's because of the double shift. It just adds up quicker. I mean, for me, I've been working on this book because I started pitching it around now 3 years ago. So I feel like I've been living in Flashland for over 3 years because it was May of 2015 that the first time it came up, the idea of me writing it. So it's been 3 years of me thinking nonstop Flash stuff.
Well, what is that writing schedule like where you're doing – I mean, you know, it's one of – DC's more major characters. I mean, he's, you know, he's in the big seven, but when you're writing 2 issues a month, do you have time to think about anything else?
The answer is no, but you have to. I mean, I've been, it's a full-time job. Like, and it's crazy because I've been working on pretty much nonstop events this whole time too. Cause it was like, once I started working on Flash, then I was doing Justice League Suicide Squad. And then I was doing The Button. I was doing Metal, and then I was doing No Justice, and now we're talking about this stuff right here. So it's like, you know, at the same time, I was also doing that. I was also doing Birthright. I mean, the thing is that, like, the year that I did RoboCop, that year, I was on the book. That year, I did 56 scripts that year. So that was more than one a week. So, like, I know I can do one a week if I had to, but Flash, even though I have, like, other things I do, like, you know, when I'm working on the event stuff or working with Justice League Odyssey or doing Birthright or other things and other stuff that hasn't been announced yet, all that stuff, Flash is still the thing I think about every day. Like, it's the one that I think about the most is Flash.
Will you just, like, block out a week and write, you know, 2 or 3 issues at a time? Or do you finish an issue of Flash, go into an issue of something else, then come back to it and then, you know, do an issue of Birthright?
Each week has sort of a set thing of, like, this is the priority for the week, but other stuff kind of bounces in and out. So, like, this week the priority was issue of Flash, But I'm also doing notes on another issue of Flash that's an older one. I have some stuff on Birthright I have to do, and then I have some stuff that I have to do for Odyssey. So it's like, this week's priority was the Flash. But the way I work is the first half of the day, so from when I get into my office at 7 a.m., so from 7 to about 1, I work on whatever is supposed to be done that day. So it's like, whether it's Flash or Birthright or Odyssey, whatever is supposed to be done that day, that's what I work on. And then once I hit 1 o'clock, then I usually stop, and then it's like notes, and then whatever else is need to be done, emails, stuff. I mean, the business of comics, you know, it's like all that stuff happens then. But like, to me, the ideal is I usually break an issue on Monday. So I hope what I do now is I have a whiteboard. I have two whiteboards, one for outlines and one for scripts. And I put the one for scripts on my desk on Monday. And I sit there and I just stare at it, and I write 1 to 20 on this whiteboard, and I almost like draw out the comic, kind of. Like, I sit there and I kind of think it through. I kind of write some stuff down. I kind of go, okay, here's what I think is happening on each page, and that way I can visually see it in front of me. Like, I can lean back and actually see the whole issue. I do that all day Monday. It's one of the funnest parts of the whole thing for me. Then I wake up on Tuesday. If I feel comfortable in it, like I know the flow, then on Tuesday I write the whole thing, essentially. Like, I'll write out kind of like a plot first version of it, page by page, and then I just keep going until it's done, you know. Like, the next day I kind of go back at it going, and then by Thursday usually I'm done. But that's also if I have a tight outline. And Monday is really where like the hardest work comes in, but it's also like the funnest part, because I'm like making the comic almost. I can visually see it. But yeah, that's like the ideal version of things, but sometimes things pop up here and there, you know, life can happen, and then sometimes something comes up that's a priority, and it's like, I have to do this now, and, you know, you want to make sure your artists are always working, you know, like, you never want your artists to be waiting for you, because, like, if they're waiting for you, that means they're also waiting for a paycheck, and you, like, never want that. You never want them, like, burning hours, especially considering, you know, it's just unfair. So I try to keep that in mind. So sometimes it's like, oh, I gotta make sure I finish this stuff up to just keep the train running, you know?
For fear of making a pun,
by the way,
your Flash has a lot of moving parts.
Yes, it does.
It, you know, you don't have just Barry as the focus of the book, or just Wally, or not even just one Wally as the focus of the book, right? You've got, as is often stated in the newest issue, number 50, and in Flash War, you know, this is a Flash family. It's in some ways a team book even. And I wonder if that makes it in some ways easier for you to have more characters to work with and kind of more to fill the pages with, or is it harder for you to kind of juggle, you know, serving all those characters in a book that, you know, literally has to keep moving at such a kind of a breakneck pace?
Definitely harder when there's more characters. Like, we're actually gonna get away from that a little bit, because, you know, Wally is not gonna be in the book much after 51, because 51 is like an epilogue to Flash War, so he's gonna leave the book for a little bit. Kid Flash will be in Titans, so moving forward I'm mostly focused on Barry, a little bit of Commander Cole, because Commander Cole got left behind, so him and Barry are gonna be kind of reluctant partners for about 6 issues. And then a focus will kind of go back down to being just Barry and Iris. And I'm really excited about it. Like, I've already written the first issue of that. And the first issue is very, it allows me to let the characters breathe a little more and let the scenes breathe a little bit more, because I don't have as many characters to worry about. I don't know. It's weird. It's tough. Like, I really enjoyed writing Flash War and Perfect Storm. Like, it was kind of cool to write it at that pace, to write it just like nonstop. But it was also really nice to kind of slow down a little bit, just have these nice kind of character moments that breathe a little bit. I definitely prefer the smaller casts. That's the thing that I've kind of learned in the last few years. Even back when I was doing Illuminati and Marvel, I learned that I like doing the smaller casts. I mean, I did Justice League Suicide Squad, and there's this 2-page spread that has like all the characters that had essentially had parts in it. And there's 19, I think it's 19 or 21 characters on this 2-page spread. And they all had to like have something to do, and I couldn't believe we were doing that for like 6 issues. Like, we had definitely had like arcs for everybody and moments for everyone, and everyone had a little thing. that can be really challenging sometimes because you just want to have room to do, like, I don't know. You want to have room to kind of do cinematic stuff in comics. That's the wrong word. I was like saying let it breathe a little bit, you know? Let it just kind of, like, the story have kind of character moments and action and aspect shots and just kind of let the environment breathe a little. Yeah, dude, it can be tough when you have a lot of characters. It can be tough because it's hard to find those character moments sometimes, like the room to let them have character moments because you're just constantly going. But the thing about Flash War is that Flash War was something that had been building up for a while in the book, so I was able to do that. But then it's cool that to do that and slow down right afterward for a little bit.
How far ahead do you work when you're on a book like Flash that's coming out twice a week, but also...
Twice a month.
I know what happens in 75, and 75 doesn't come out until July of next year, a year from now. Like, right now I'm writing issues that are going to be coming out at the end of the year, so I'm about 6 to 7 months ahead, I guess, 6 months ahead. But there's an issue I'm going to write this summer that won't come out. The next issue, not the next one, but probably this 2 issues from now, because you also have to write things out of order a little bit to make sure that you can keep up with that schedule. The next issue I write, that I'm going to write in August, that issue will not come out until May of next year. So, wild. But I also plan really far out too, you know? And that's the thing when you were talking about moving parts. It's like, in The Flash, I have so many subplots. Because it's like, yeah, I have this stuff with Wally and Kid Flash and Barry, but there's all kinds of stuff with, like, the Rogues that we've been building up. There's stuff like, there was a subplot at the end of last year that there's somebody running organized crime in Central City and you don't know who it is. You thought it was Copperhead or Captain Cole, but it's somebody else. And we, like, showed them in the shadows. We're not going to show who that person is for a little bit. Like, there's little things like that that, like, because I love long-term storytelling like that. I like that if somebody sits down and goes back and reads, they're going to be like, oh, he seeded them. Like, even that thing at the end, the new forces in Flash, if you go back and you look at the Flash annual that came out in January, Commander Cole straight out says there's new forces here. Like, he sees it then. And then at the beginning of that issue, he talks about how Iron Heights only holds one person, and it was the only thing that Eobard Thawne ever did. The only good thing Eobard Thawne ever did was that one person. And that was teased in the annual in January, and we just showed that prison break in Flash 50 this week. So I love really long-term storytelling. So that's also a part of it, is keeping track of that in my head. Like, there's all kinds of weird little stuff. Like, there's a supporting character in the book named Kristen, who's Barry's CSI partner at Iron Heights. And we've had 2 issues where they talk about her having a secret boyfriend. And that's not, I'm not putting that out there for no reason. Her boyfriend is somebody. Like, that's a little bit of a spoiler we'll get to down the line. But I put that there for a reason, because in my head, I know that's going to be something down the line.
Do you ever feel the need, like, do you ever second guess yourself, I guess is my question? Because I mean, look, I don't plan ahead at all. Like, it is an endless source of frustration for Chad that I'm like, nope, I'll figure it out when I get there.
I don't know. Yes and no. I think there was a moment that we were kind of like that, where we were like, oh, I'll figure it out, but not anymore, I think. I think at this point, like, the train is running, and I know the story, and sometimes things change here and there, but I don't know. I mean, I second-guess myself as I'm working, but it just pushes you to do bigger and better. I'm trying to think if anything has ever really changed, like, drastically like that, just because I, like, second-guess myself last minute. I don't think so. I think that there was times where things didn't work out, but I look back and it was like, that didn't work out, because Wally was originally going to be in the book during the Eobard Thawne storyline we did last year. He was going to be in that, and it was just because I wanted him in the book. It wasn't because I had an actual story reason. I just wanted him in the book, and DC was like, well, what's the reason? I was like, I don't know, I just want him in the book. And they're like, okay, you can't do that. that worked out because then later on, that's what led to me, like, okay, can I do Flash War? And they were like, sure, what's it about? And I told them, and they were like, okay, that makes sense, yes, you can do that. And then they were like, but you need to get Wally in the book sooner so you can seed it. And I was like, yes. So that's why I was able to get Wally in the book for Perfect Storm, and I was with the LeGrand storyline and the annual.
Well, clearly it is working out pretty well for you, because you're doing some great stuff on that book.
I really like writing it. Like, I know, it's really weird, man, because I've been reading Flash comics since I was a kid, and so it's like, I was reading it the whole time. It wasn't like I stopped reading it and then all of a sudden I got the job. Like, I was a regular, I've been a regular monthly Flash reader since I was like 12 years old. So maybe, yeah, 12. So it's weird. Like, at some point someone gave it to me. It's just really strange. And really, really surreal. But I love it, dude. I don't know. I really like doing it.
I mean, will you keep writing Flash until they make you stop?
Yeah, they're going to have to kill me.
That's the real Flash war.
They're going to have to, like, dude, I mean, there was a moment it came up in a conversation about if I would leave. It was just in the mix of conversations. I mean, you can tell, like, I think that Tom and I are the only people that are still on our books from the beginning of Rebirth. And Scott Lobdell, I think, on Red Hood. I'm not 100% sure, but I think most people have kind of switched around on their books at this point. There was a moment we had a conversation of, you know, would you leave? When would you leave? What would the story be? And then I pitched Flash War. And then once I pitched Flash War and the book was just keep it, it was a, I don't know, I think they have a lot of confidence in me at this point with the book. Like, it's obviously working and the sales are really strong. And they can tell I'm really passionate about it. But I'm not like a fanboy who's, because that's one of the things I heard Dan and Jeff talk about this years ago. They were at a panel and they were talking about you have to be a pro, you can't be the fan. You can't let the fan rule you, you know. That passion and love can be there. You can obviously see that with like Jeff. But you still have to be professional about it. It's funny, like, I love those characters so much. And I was talking to someone else about this recently, and I think you guys know this. Like, when you're a writer, your job is to be the bad guy for your character. So it's like, I'm not so precious about the Flash that I won't put Barry and Wally and you know, the Flash family through hell.
If I can figure out how to be the professional and not the fan, that would be great.
Oh, dude, it is that, I'll be straight with you, it's one of the hardest parts of the job. When you love the character so much, you have to like be real with yourself about it. Like, every day I'm just like, how am I going to kill Barry Allen the day? Or how am I going to try to kill Barry Allen the day? I'm like the worst James Bond villain. I'm just like sitting there like monologuing about how I'm going to kill him the day.
Well, can we talk about Justice League Odyssey a little bit while we still have a little time?
Yeah.
I mainly want to talk about how that team came together. Like, was there a draft among all you guys, like, to pick who you wanted?
It changed a bunch of times. I think the two characters that were always on it were always Cyborg and Starfire. Cyborg and Starfire kind of fluctuated a little bit here and there, but then once we knew, because we started talking about that book at the end of, not even the end of last year, probably like October of last year. And so we knew it was always going to be Cyborg and Starfire, and the team kept getting bigger and the smaller and bigger and smaller. We were talking about having a Green Lantern on the book. I wanted Jessica because I liked Jessica, and so they were cool with that. Darkseid, there was a conversation about Darkseid because of all the stuff that he's been going through the last few years since Darkseid War. And so because at one point I wanted Orion on the book, and it was going to be Orion, but Orion was going to have all these interactions with Darkseid, and we were going to have all this stuff about Fourth World. And then at one point the thing came up of like, well, why don't I just have Darkseid? And this is really early on, like, even in developing the story and stuff, so it wasn't like a random thing. But I remember when we started talking about that, I was like, hell yeah, I love Darkseid. Why not? Let's try that. And then I started thinking a lot about it being this, like, Hannibal thing, and it kind of changed the shape of the book in a lot of ways. The odd man out is Azrael. And I'm nerdy enough to say the reason Azrael's there is because I wanted Azrael to be there. I mean, I literally have a copy. I have a copy of the Sword of Azrael on my desk right now, or it's actually on the shelf next to my desk, just because I love it. Like, my age group, like, Nightfall is, like, always going to be a big deal, and I've always liked his character. Like, I was so happy when I found out that he was going to be in James's book, and then James was showing me the designs on the armor that he was going to wear, the Nightfall armor, and I was super, super excited about it. So with this, when I knew James was leaving Detective, I just asked, I was like, can I have Azrael? And they were like, well, what's his purpose in the book? And then we started talking about that a lot, about how he could be there, what it meant. He's been the biggest challenge, but he's fun too, because he is the POV. Because all those characters have been in space before. They all know space. He's the only one that is like, can I go back to Gotham, please? Like, this is too much. I should have stayed in Gotham. And so he's been kind of fun to write with that. But it's also really cool to see like a dope-ass Batman armor flying in space. That stuff's fun. So
look, you know I support that.
Yeah. So that's really how that team came together. And there's some other stuff that kind of comes in and out of the book as we go. But yeah, we had a lot of fun putting that team together. It's funny, somewhere in here I have like a notebook that has all the different characters we talked about putting in the book, and I think we're going to put in the book eventually. But those are the ones that like survived the gauntlet of us trying to figure it out. But it's been a lot of fun working with those characters. It's such a different – the challenge with them is because some of them know each other, some of them don't. And it really is like a new team dynamic with them interacting for the first time in some cases. So that's been kind of a challenge of writing those characters. But this is always the thing about team books is all the characters have such distinct voices. And like when you're writing a solo book, no matter what happens, like for me, when I was writing Nailbiter, if I could hear Warren, the Nailbiter, if I could hear his voice, if I knew what he was saying throughout the issue would just write itself. Same thing with Flash. Like if I can hear Barry's, you know, inner monologue in my head, then I know that's the focal point of the issue. With a team book like this, where it isn't just one character's voice, it's a bunch of voices, that can be challenging. Trying to find a way of striking that balance. I mean, you know what always is happening is like one or two characters end up taking the reins a little bit. Like you can always see on X-Men books where it always be like somebody's POV, like Kitty Pryde, or you know, it's always like Wolverine or Wolverine's sidekick. So it's like Kitty Pryde, Jubilee, you know, it's like somebody would always fill that role for, I think, the writer. And there's a reason for that, because it's definitely easier. It's easier when you use one person's point of view on a team book.
Speaking of points of view and different characters, different voices, I'm a little curious about, I guess, what you would call the division of labor on Justice League No Justice, that miniseries.
Yeah, sure.
Because you had yourself, James Tynion, and Scott Snyder all writing that book. And you know, sometimes on books like that, it can be easy to tell, or at least it can feel easy to guess who wrote what. But on that book, it felt like everything gelled pretty well. So I kind of want to hear a little bit about, you know, how you guys divided up the writing on that series.
So Scott and James and I, we talk every day, like throughout the day. I'll probably talk to Scott on the phone, like, right after I get off with you guys, I'm going to go pick up food for my wife and I, and I'll probably talk to him in the car on the way to pick the food up.
Please tell him we said hi.
I will. But yeah, so the three of us talk every day, and so a lot of times we're always in that mode of either talk story out, or we're always passing scripts or outlines or just, you know, dialogue drafts, PDFs, whatever. We've been doing that for years now, just passing stuff back and forth. And so because we do that, already kind of in that mode, and so when we started working on Metal, we were really into doing that, like passing stuff back and forth. When it comes to No Justice, man, it's tough. Like, all of us touched it in some way or another. Like, there's not a line in that book that is, like, any one person's. I think Lobo saying we're fragged at the end of issue one is something I know I wrote. The rest, I don't even know. Like, I think we just kept passing stuff around. Like, you know, Scott and I would talk some stuff out. I would type a bunch of stuff up. I would hand it over to James. James would type a bunch of stuff out, or he'd flesh something out, hand it back to me. I would flesh some stuff out, hand it back to Scott. Scott would flesh some stuff out. I would do like a rough pass on dialogue. James would come in and do a rough pass on dialogue, and then Scott would come in and do a pass on dialogue. So it wasn't like, because it's funny to me when I have some people co-write with each other, and they'll be like, I wrote the first half, you wrote the second half. And I'm like, oh my God, you guys are crazy. It's how? How? With us, it was literally just like a round robin of us just like just passing it back and forth until you got to the end of it. And you know, we went down to Burbank in October, oh, in beginning of November, and we went in there with a gigantic whiteboard in the offices, and we broke the whole thing, and then we went again in January to like make sure it was all working. And so when it comes to like all the major beats of the book, like we all know it, we all planned that stuff and worked it all out together. And then, yeah, dude, then it's just a lot of passing documents around. Like sometimes I think I was the one that started the documents off based on our notes and the whiteboard. But then after that, dude, it's like, it's pretty nutty how we were working on that stuff. And then we would talk some stuff out on the phone. And then sometimes, like, you know, one of, like, Scott would call, and the three of us would do a conference call, and we'd be like, okay, here's what we're thinking about this. And then it'd be like, okay, well, I'm going to tackle these five pages. You do those five pages on dialogue. And I'll do these five pages. But then we would do that, but then we would pass it all around again anyway. So, yeah, it was definitely, like, a crazy experience, but I'm really happy with it in the end. And Francis, and then also, you know, Francis Menpool comes in there and adds his whole thing. So yeah, I feel like it was a fourth writer because of Francis, but, yeah, dude, it was a nutty thing. Cause I talked to some people co-write and their systems where it's like, you know, one person does the plot, another person does the dialogue, or one person describes the panel, another person does the dialogue. We weren't like that at all. It was every little bit of that book was touched by all of us. It was really nutty.
Matt, if our listeners want to get in on these conversations that we have each and every week here on War Rocket Ajax, how can they go about that?
Well, Chris, all they have to do is find their way into Hypertime and blast through Hypertime, change history so that you created a Twitter account when Twitter was still fun.
Mm-hmm.
Follow the Matt D. Wilson, that's me, and the ISB, that's Chris, and then wait until July 2018. Just sit in Hypertime and wait until July 2018, and wait until Thursday at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 6:30 Pacific Time. And one of us will put out the call for questions for our guest, and you can ask a question just like these questions you're about to hear for Joshua Williamson. We're going to start with this quick question from Ryan Will Downey on Twitter, who asks, who is the white whale character that, Josh, you've always wanted to write but haven't had the opportunity?
I mean, it's weird because I've gotten to write a lot of the characters at this point that I've wanted to write. It's weird. For a really long time, I always wanted – this is not the answer, but for a really long time, I wanted to write Green Arrow, and it just never worked out. I could just never get it to happen. Like, if I would get close – like, we would have Green Arrow in an issue, or we'd have Green Arrow in something, and then somehow it wouldn't work out. It was always, like, really funny. I would try to sneak him into stuff and get cut. I feel like the answer is obvious, and that's Batman. But mm-hmm. I feel like it's funny. I was really obsessed with writing The Flash, and so that's also the kind of the weird thing, is that I kind of got what I wanted in a lot of ways. Like, I never thought I would get to write The Flash. I was super obsessed with The Flash. And like, if you saw my office, I have, like, a bunch of Flash toys in here and statues and stuff. Like, I always wanted to write The Flash. And so it's really weird that, like, I was kind of given the thing I always wanted. And I've gotten to write Batman a few times, like, with the button. And, I mean, he's in an issue of Flash coming up. So it's always weird. Like, it's tough. I don't know. I'm trying to think of, oh, I know. Well, see, even that. Like, at this point, I've been in a weird zone where it's like the Hulk is a character I wanted to write. I've been able to write the Hulk twice now. But I haven't been able to do, like, a Hulk run with something I would want to do. Or Wolverine. Sometimes I want to write Spider-Man. I think he'd be challenging to write in a way. Yeah, I would say Batman is probably the answer. I actually have, like, a Batman book that is mine. I think that's the white whale. Because I feel like Batman isn't a book you asked for. It's a book that you were given.
It is bestowed upon you.
Yes, yes. I know some people ask for it all the time, but I feel like it's weird with that. I also, like, with Batman, I feel like it really is, because that is the top of the game, you know? Like, Batman is the top. It's the top book. It always sells the most. I mean, you know, it's the very first book that Diamond ever entered into the Diamond Systems was Killing Joke. So if you ever go look at, like, all the diamond codes, they're always like these long numbers, but that one is like 00001. It's the book that is the standard for sales, all that stuff, dude. So I feel like Batman is the one that is probably the white whale.
Here's a question from Andy Curry, which is gloating in the formal question. Andy says, Josh, do you know that he has the original Impulse retail promo poster by Humberto Ramos, and are you jealous?
A little bit, yeah. I wish I still had all of it, because I worked at a comic book store when I was in high school. It was a little after that. It was Impulse was already, like, coming out for a couple years by the time I got that job. But all those old promo posters, I wish I had them all. So, yeah, a little bit.
CJ Tour wants some flash facts from you, sure. Josh. He asks, what sets the Rogues apart from other villains?
Oh, man, that's tough. I mean, I guess from, like, you can debate this with me, but, like, Batman's rogues, I think, they're crazy, right? They're malicious. And I feel like you could argue, I've had this conversation about the rogues before. There's something about the rogues that is, they're obviously blue collar, right? Like, they're blue collar criminals with superpowers or with stuff that makes them, you know, like with the cold gun and stuff like that. But what's weird about them is people are oddly really defensive about them. So it's like, no one's going to defend the Joker. Like, we all kind of recognize Joker as a crazy person. He's horrible. And most of Batman's villains and most of Superman's villains, people have this thing where it's like, Lex Luthor is a bad guy. He is a bad person. He will do bad things and get what he wants. You kind of don't have that conversation about the rogues. Like, you kind of feel like the rogues are like the blue collar guys that you kind of root for. Like, it's a party that kind of wants them to get away with it. It kind of wants them to like get one over on the Flash. And it's funny, I was having a conversation a couple years ago. We were talking about the rogues with one of my editors. We were talking about villains who kill and what that means. And the editor, we started this conversation about them. And they had kind of forgotten that the rogues have killed people. Like, that's the kind of characters they are. People forget that they're also killers because they like them so much. They like them as that blue-collar person.
You certainly never hear the argument that you always hear with, you know, the Joker. You never hear, like, hey, why doesn't the Flash just kill Mirror Master?
Yeah, exactly. But the Mirror Master does a lot of messed up stuff. He's probably the most crazy of that group.
Yeah, I feel like Mirror Master did his worst stuff to Animal Man, though.
So I feel like I was talking to somebody about Mirror Master last week. I'm not going to say who it was because it was like a conversation about Mirror Master stories. And we were just talking about how much he could be easily like a horror character. You know? Like, he could easily be a character that you would think of as being... There's a way of playing him much scarier than we play him.
I am a big fan of the trope of just supervillains with jobs. Like, it's they got to get up in the morning and put on that blue coat with the hood and go out and rob a bank just like everybody else.
Yeah. I mean, they're all in prison now, and I feel like they're the kind of people that at this point are going to be like, what is that phrase for, like, career, not career criminals, but people who just, like, live in prison. Like, they're just career prisoners. But yeah, they're definitely career criminals that, like, they hang out at a bar together. And the Flash would, like, go in that bar. You know? Like, there's something oddly, I don't want to say unthreatening, because I feel like that is unfair. But the idea that they live by a code, where I don't think a lot of other villains necessarily live by that code.
Here's one that I don't know how much you could say about, Josh, so tell as much as you can tell. Austin Wilden, sure, at WC_wit on Twitter, wants to know, will we learn more about what exactly the Tiger Force is in Justice League Odyssey?
I don't know what that even is in Justice League Odyssey.
The Tiger Force at the center of all things is Darkseid, of course.
Oh, why is he in Justice League Odyssey? Yeah, of course. There's a reason. It's in issue one, and then issue two, we kind of dive into it a little bit more. But yeah, of course, there's a reason. We'll get to that pretty quickly. Like, I don't want to drag that one out. You'll know very quickly why he's there.
This is going to be our last one, I think. This is from Uzi on Twitter, at EWZZY. They want to know, what's Bloodwind up to?
I bet you that's because my friend, he drew a picture of Bloodwind. My friend Jason Ho, he's the art director at Bongo. He drew a picture of Bloodwind today, and I retweeted it because I just really like Bloodwind. I actually don't know what Bloodwind's up to. Because I don't know if he's been in anything post-New 52 or Rebirth. He might have been. So I don't know. I don't know what Bloodwind is up to. He's not Martian Manhunter anymore. I know that. Like, he's a completely different character, right? Yeah, I don't know what he's doing. I'll have to find out. Maybe I'll put him in one of the books. I always liked Bloodwind's design. I liked it except for he had the one gold bracelet around his leg. And it drove me crazy because it was only around one leg. It was like, again, like I said earlier, like, no half measures, right? Like, don't have it. If you're going to have the weird gold bracelet around your leg, have it on both or neither. Don't put it on just one.
But don't get rid of that good vampire cape. That's, we gotta keep
that. No way, the cape was dope.
Yeah.
I really liked his design a lot. I always thought he was kind of cool. It didn't, this is the thing that's funny about when you're like a really, you know, I know you guys know this, when you're like a really nerdy kid in comics when you're young, all this stuff that like everyone else thinks is stupid, you think is awesome.
Don't know a thing about what that's like. Not familiar with that feeling at all.
I did not know that Bloodwind was not cool until I was much older. So somebody came to me there. I was talking when I was working at the comic store in college, and I was talking about Bloodwind, and they were like, they were very confused by my love of Bloodwind. So that I liked his design. That era, I liked that era of Justice League. So I don't know.
Well, Bloodwind rules. But that is all the time we have. Our guest has been Josh Williamson. Can you tell everybody where they can find you online if you would like to be found?
Yeah, just Twitter. Just Williamson_Josh. That's the place to get me. If I don't answer you, it's just because I have Twitter blocked for like 80% of the day. And I don't have Twitter on my phone. So I'm like super slow to respond to people on Twitter stuff. But that is definitely where you can follow me. I do post. And I try to get back to people on there.
All right, well, Joshua Williamson, thank you so much. Flash is out now. Just Justice League Odyssey will be out in September.
September, yeah, September.
And you have an amazing back catalog of great comics. So thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Are you guys going to San Diego?
No. It's going to be 35 degrees.
Well, I will not see you there then. But have a good night, guys. Thank you. Good night.
Thanks to Joshua Williamson for joining us for a very, very fun conversation. But now it's the time of the show where we answer some questions sent in by you, the listeners. Matt, it's time for listener questions.
That's right. Here is a question that was sent in to our Tumblr at warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com. It's somewhat appropriate for July. We're a little after the 4th of July, but this would be appropriate for that. And the question is, why hasn't Batman really been presented as a uniquely American hero in the same way that Superman or even Spider-Man have? You don't see a lot of images of Batman and the flag out there, which I think is an interesting point. You see Superman and the flag all the time. Mm-hmm. Spider-Man and the flag certainly became a more prevalent image around the time of the movies, the Sam mm-hmm. Raimi movies. But it is just not something you see associated with Batman almost ever. Maybe in the Golden Age.
I mean, there was a lot of it in the Golden Age, as there was with everyone.
Yeah.
You know? During World War II, there were a lot of superheroes who were carrying around the flag.
And weirdly, like, you know, there are two superheroes I can think of that wear the flag. One of them is Captain America. The other is Wonder Woman, who is not American.
Not American. That's the one thing that I'm like, fine, change her costume, because it does not make sense for her to wear a flag.
Yeah.
Not at all. Honestly, I think it's a question of aesthetics. I don't think Batman goes with the flag.
Is it just a color scheme deal?
Yeah, it's just a color scheme thing. It would look weird. Think about, like, Batman aesthetics. It's always night. It's the colors you're looking at are blue, black, gray, and yellow. You don't get the flag imagery out of that. It doesn't look right. Beyond that, just in terms of, like, why don't we see, you know, Batman in that kind of imagery, it is weird, but I think Batman is kind of weirdly... I say this as a dude who loves Batman. He is weirdly antithetical to the American dream because he's old money.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of aspects.
British butler, Matt.
There's a lot of aspects to the Batman story that are not the typical American dream success story in the way that Superman is. Superman grew up on a farm, not exactly poor, but not rich either, and came to the city and made it. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Batman is born rich, has everything he could possibly have, leaves America to become Batman.
Yeah.
Notably. And also a lot of what is entrenched in the Batman story is about the seedy underbelly of the United States,
mm-hmm.
about crime and corruption and dirty cops and like a lot of stuff that doesn't necessarily go hand in hand with patriotism.
Yeah. Yeah. He is a character who is, he is American in that, like, America is the native country of the superhero comic genre. So he has that, like, you know, Glenn Weldon writes a lot about the sort of origins of Batman and how it was a very big thing in the Depression to see, like, you know, the fantasy of the rich man, but also he would, like, you know, mix with the lower classes, I think is a way that he puts it. And, you know, he's Batman, he's a billionaire, but he goes to the circus and his kid's a carny. Like, there's a lot of that, but I think that doesn't get the, he's a different kind of character than the characters who lend themselves to patriotic stories.
Yeah. I mean, he's a character seated in tragedy.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, but you know, so is Spider-Man, but Spider-Man is also like a weird self-made guy. You know, that's one of the reasons the web shooters are so important. He makes them.
Yeah.
He figured it out.
I mean, there's all this stuff about his dad making the initial designs for them or whatever, but he makes the web fluid and built the web shooters.
Here's another thing about Spider-Man and Batman, right? They're both characters designed for a city. Spider-Man can't exist without specifically New York. Spider-Man does not exist in Chicago, even, you know? He has to be in Manhattan. He has to be in that crowded ass tall buildings. It's the only environment in which Spider-Man works. It's why you can't take him out of it. Batman is designed for a city in a different way. He's designed for the shadows. He's designed for the street of that city. You know, they both swing through the buildings, but Spider-Man walks on the walls and Batman stands in the alleys. And I think that shift in imagery, like, where do you see, like, Spider-Man hanging out with flags? It's when there's flagpoles on the side of buildings. You don't see that with Batman. Because he is either swinging through them or standing and punching someone.
Yeah, I mean, Batman is surrounded by his own symbology. He's surrounded by the spotlight on the clouds and that kind of thing, not so much flags.
Yeah, and he goes back to, like, other weird traditions. Like, think about the characters that Batman's kind of rooted in. It's Sherlock Holmes and Zorro and Dracula, who are three very non-American characters.
Yeah. So, this is all conjecture on our part, I suppose, but these are the pretty solid reasons, I think, for why, you just never see Batman with a flag.
Yeah, an interesting question that I've never really thought of, and I've thought a lot about Batman, so thank you for sending that in.
All right, that does it for our listener question segment. If you would like to send in a question, you can do so at our Tumblr, which is warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com. You can also send it to us by email, warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. That is also where you can send Every Story Ever lists, panel president lists. If you want to sponsor the show, you can let us know there. Or if you just want to drop us a line about something else, check out our website, which is warrocketajax.com. That is where you can stream the show, download the show, read show notes, and leave comments. It is also where you can see the Every Story Ever and panel president lists. Check us out on Apple Podcasts also, or whatever app you use to listen to podcasts, and leave us a review there if you are so inclined. It would help us out to get some 5-star reviews to raise the profile of the show. Now we've reached the part of the show where we tell you all the different places you can find us online. For me, all you have to do is go to mattdwilson.net to find links to everything that I do. My other podcasts, my books, my comics, and all my social media presences are right there at mattdwilson.net. Chris, where can people find your stuff?
People can find my stuff by going to the-isb.com. There's links there to everything that I do. I even put the Apocryphiles link there now, so it's all there. You can also find me at your local comic book store, or if you get comics online, Infinity Countdown Darkhawk, just ended this last week, as did Kiss vs. the Army of Darkness. I had two books out on Wednesday, Matt, which is pretty exciting.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It was a two-book day for your good friend. And make sure to tell your retailer that you are very interested in finding out what's going on with Sleepwalker as Infinity Wars kicks off. That's going to do it for our show. Before we get out of here, we do have a good cause that we would like to direct our listeners to.
That's right. You can go to TexasCivilRightsProject.org. That is the website of the Texas Civil Rights Project, where you can donate to help with the ongoing family separation crisis. You can click on the top link right there on their website and help that organization try to reunite families at the border, because they have been separated for some time now, well past the court deadline to reunite them. And it would be good if those families could be reunited. So Texas Civil Rights Project is one of the organizations that is trying all they can to make those families whole again. So if you can go help out there, please go do that.
All righty, Matt, that does it. This has been Warrock at Ajax number 411. What's the 411 on whether we were HQC or not?
Let me ring them up. Hang on.
Okay.
Boop, 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 boop. Information. Oh, hi. I just wanted to ask if this was HQC. I gotta look it up in the book. It says here it was HQC. Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate you looking that up for me. Okay, bye-bye. Click. A little rude, but yeah, it was HQC.
The great thing about that, Matt, is that it was both HQC and ASMR. Have a great week, everybody.
We love you.
Yeah! Flash.